Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. I am so glad you're joining us today because we have got a terrific show, one that is all over the board when it comes to local food and drink, which I think is pretty fun. First of all, because it feels like spring, and I know some of you are itching to get out there and dig in the garden, we've got an update from Master Gardener Joellen Meyer Sharp of HoosierGardener.com about what you can and can't do in the garden this time of year. We also talk with Hancock County farmer Jonathan Lawler, who you probably know from our interviews with him about his efforts to grow produce for food pantries with Brandywine Creek Farms. But this week we are talking with him about his plans for raising alligators indoors, aquaponically, right here in Indiana. And since the James Beard Foundation just released its list of semifinalists for their Restaurant and Chef Awards, we have an interview with semifinalist Aaron Butts. We talked with him this time last year about his background in cooking and his plans for the Golden in Fort Wayne. And now that the Golden is open and he's made that semifinalist list again, it seemed like a great time to revisit last year's interview. And finally this week, we head to Fountain Square in Indianapolis to the Nine Lives Cat Cafe to talk with owner Selena Hubbard and her dad Eric about what it's like to open a coffee shop where customers can actually hang out with cats. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, if you're like me, this unseasonably warm weather has got you thinking of springtime in February. I can't help it. After all the dreary, gloomy days, to have some 60-degree temperatures has got me ready to go to the garden center. But Master Gardener Joellen Meyer Sharp, a regular here on Eat Drink Indie Radio, is trying her best to talk me out of it. Joellen fills us in on what you should and shouldn't be doing in the garden this time of year, and she tells us a bit about the year of the brassica, too. Is it too early to be thinking about spring?
Well, we can think about spring anytime. It's not really too early to be thinking about spring, especially if you are thinking about having a vegetable garden or a flower garden. This is a good time to sort of plan for that, draw a little sketch, go through the gardening catalogs
you might get,
or go online. A lot of the nurseries and, you know, garden catalogs are available online, and you can order everything online. You can research the plant online. You can see how tall it's going to be, if it needs sun or shade.
Right.
You know, all the things that you'd want to know in planning your garden.
So, but beyond the planning, which is wonderful, and I can get lost in those seed catalogs, but beyond that, you know, we've had some very warm, unseasonably warm weather lately. Is it too early to be doing something?
It's too early to be doing something.
Oh.
Because I know people get wigged out because the daffodils and
yes,
the tulips start to emerge.
Right.
And they're sort of trained. They can handle that. And people always want to know if they should add mulch or something like that. No, they don't need to add mulch.
So it's okay when they're peeking up.
It's okay when they're peeking up,
okay.
Yes. So the thing about working in the garden right now is the ground is still pretty wet and it's frozen.
Yes.
And so traipsing on the soil, walking on the grass,
oh,
you know, stirring up the beds really destroys all of the good work we do to try to build the soil.
So I'm not doing it any favors getting in there too early.
No, you're not. We just, in compacting the soil, it inhibits root growth and development. And it doesn't allow water, air, and other nutrients to work down into the soil.
So I have to restrain myself from getting out there and digging too early.
I think we've talked before about gardening teaching us patience, Jolene.
You make that point when we talk about that. And I'm afraid I might fall into the category of the people who go out and buy their plants a little too early.
Maybe. It depends on what, excuse me, on what you're buying.
Well, so we're going to start seeing things in the home and garden centers probably within the next month or so, right?
We will, and we'll start seeing what they call cool season crops or cool season plants. So those are pansies and violas and flowers, you know, some other flowers, ranunculus, cinerarias, And then we'll see potted daffodils and tulips also. Right. Those have been forced to bloom. And we can incorporate those in spring pots, you know, so we put those in there with some pansies or whatever. And then in the vegetable area, we'll see brassicas.
Okay, now tell me about brassicas. First, tell me what it is. What are they?
Well, they're probably some of our more common vegetables. There are more aromatic vegetables. How's that?
Aromatic, okay. That's
aromatic,
a good word.
You like that? So the brassica family is cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, collards, mustards, kohlrabi, radish, rutabaga, turnip, and Chinese cabbage like bok choy or pak choy.
Okay, so now those are sort of the sort of, as you said, aromatic, but kind of strong vegetables.
Yes, yes, they are. But they're loaded with lots of vitamins and minerals, so they're good for us. I mean, kale is like huge right now,
kale,
and it's in that
right.
family.
Right. Okay. So brassicas, we can start thinking about that. But it is the year of the brassicas.
It is. The National Garden Bureau has announced 2017 is the year of brassica. And people can find out more about those plants and how to grow them at its website, ngb.org. That's N is in National, G is in Garden, Bureau is in B.org. And that is a trade group of seed merchants and plant breeders and marketers. Mm-hmm. And they encourage people to grow plants.
Okay, so but what is it about brassicas that makes it that makes them able to be planted or put out in the very early spring?
Well, they fall under that cool season category, and so they can tolerate, you know, bits of freezing temperatures or frosty temperatures.
Oh, okay. So we can think about this in early March?
Early March is we'd be putting them out probably mid to late April into mid-April to the end of April. Once it gets hot, they sort of slow down, and they may go to seed, so they're just going to slow down their production. But you can start them indoors now if you want to.
Okay, here's something I can do, right?
Okay, yes, there's something you can do. So you can go to the garden center or order the seeds online, and you can start the seeds indoors now so that they'll be ready to plant in about a month or 6 weeks.
Okay, so I really should wait a month before I start to put anything out?
Before you put it outdoors, Jolene,
okay.
Yes. I mean, remember that patience part.
Well, I'm not really good at that part.
Well, neither am I, but I'm, you know, gardening teaches us that. There's no way we can make the tree go faster or bigger.
Or warm the ground up faster.
Yes, that's true.
Now, what should we know about these plants? Are they, first of all, are they easy to grow? Okay, the radishes I know because I'm very good with radishes and they come up quick. And so
yes,
I like those.
Radishes and turnips, you can just sort of put the seed down there and say dirt and they go, which is
exactly.
always easy. I think that makes gardeners feel really good
it
and
does.
Successful.
It does. It makes me feel successful.
Yes.
You're right.
They do have some enemies or predators in the garden, the worst probably being the cabbage worm, which is a green worm, and the little white moths or little butterflies that we see early in the season.
Oh, the very early ones?
Yes, those are actually cabbage moth. And they're the ones who lay their eggs then on the plant. The eggs hatch, form the larva, which is the worm.
Oh,
and they can eat holes in the leaves or actually almost defoliate the leaves, just leaving the veins.
So there goes my kale, right?
Yes, that's right, exactly. That's
or my cabbage, right.
And so what a lot of people do is after they plant them, they will put what's called a row cover made out of a lightweight material called Rime is a popular brand, and over the plants after they've planted them, which keeps the those moths from laying their eggs on the plants.
So which of these would you suggest people try? You know, so we have quite a big list there from broccoli and cabbage and Brussels sprouts and bok choy. What should we go for?
Well, I think cabbage is pretty easy to grow. Brussels sprouts are pretty easy to grow. And actually, broccoli is pretty easy to grow. And I mean, I tend to buy these plants actually at the farmer's market rather than grow them myself because I have a pretty small yard for one thing, but also because of the pests that are involved with them. And so if I were going to pick some to grow, it would be I've grown Brussels sprouts and cabbages, which are fine. I don't usually grow the broccoli because they tend to get little worms down into the heads. And I try to be an organic or natural gardener, so I'm not treating my plants with pesticides. I figure I can buy that at the grocery store.
Right.
And so I tend not to grow broccoli and buy that at the farmers markets.
But the leafy ones, you know, the mustard greens and collards.
Those are easy to grow, very easy. Those are like a lettuce, you know. So
that's what I'm thinking.
Again, they're the seeds that you can say dirt and they go.
Okay, now that's very encouraging, right?
And in the fall, a lot of the lettuces are used, and even the cabbages, the ornamental cabbages and kales are used in fall arrangements.
So you can, these are plants that you can probably do again later on in the season.
Yes, you can start. You can plant these out again in like late July or early August for a fall crop. And you can really extend the season quite a bit on that, again, with the row covers. Or when we know that we're having cold temperatures, you know, to throw like a sheet over them.
Right.
And a lot of the brassicas sweeten up when they've had a little bit of a chill to the plant.
So it's okay to start thinking about it this early, as long as I'm just thinking about it, right?
Unless you're wanting to start your seeds indoors.
Okay, but I can do that. Now, if I were going to start my seeds indoors, what would I do? I mean, you know, I have in my head the whole, you know, starting my seeds in little egg cartons from when I was a Girl Scout or something. How should I do that?
Yeah, you can do that. That's fine. Or you can go to the garden centers and find seed starting kits, which are usually flats, what they call flats, and, you know, get a good seed starting mix. You don't want to use soil from the garden.
Why not?
Because it could have insects or diseases in it.
Right.
And it's really, you're trying to grow this in a sort of a compromised environment anyway. And so it's better to start with a sterile mix so that you're eliminating that problem. And really, light is probably the most difficult thing, I think, for home gardeners to find in their houses. Mm-hmm. So you can buy like a shop light and put fluorescent or plant light bulbs
now,
in there.
Now, will that work?
That works great.
If I don't have a sunny enough window?
Right. You can, well, and you probably aren't going to have a sunny enough window.
Right. That's my question. Even if I have a lovely bright window, it's probably not enough yet this
time. Right.
And
you're going to, because they, what happens is if the plants don't get enough light, they stretch. And then that weakens the whole stem of the plant. And so if you're doing it in a window, you just need to keep rotating the plants every day so that they don't stretch to one side or the other. But really, the best success is going to come using supplemental light in some way. And starting out, that light is right on top of the plants. It's like 2 inches away from the plant. And then as the plants grow, you move it up the light a little bit farther away. But it's always within just a couple inches of the plant.
So any particular advice on what I should be doing specifically as I keep myself out of the garden?
Specifically?
So I should go out or I should go get some seeds and give it a try to keep myself busy so I'm not out there digging too early?
Yeah, and, you know, we young people, we like to do a lot of research online. And so, you know, to just become a little bit more familiar with the plants that you're interested in growing so you understand that, say, if you're wanting to grow cabbages or kale, that there are certain insects you have to be on guard for. You also want to know what kind of an environment it wants to grow in, if it's sunny or shady or wet or dry soil. And, you know, just the sort of a cursive review of those kinds of things, I think, really will help a lot people be a lot more successful with this.
Now, where can people look for some information? You probably have this information on your website.
I do have a lot of information at whosyourgardener.com. But the ngb.org website has tons of information and photos and step-by-steps, which will also help people. My other favorite one is Rodale's, which is Organic Life. There's a lot of information there about how to do this in a natural or organic way where we're not dependent on lots of pesticides. And also the seed catalogs have tremendous amounts of information. Tell you how long it takes from the time you sow the seed to when you can harvest it. Again, what the cultural conditions that plant would need to survive. And so there's a lot out there.
Okay, so there's a lot I can do to keep myself from doing too much too soon.
Yes, it is. And you're not going to be walking on the soil or in the beds, I know.
We've been talking with Master Gardener Joellen Meyer-Sharp
For more information on gardening in central Indiana, check out her website, HoosierGardener.com. We've talked with Hancock County farmer Jonathan Lawler here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio recently, and he's told us about his efforts with Brandywine Creek Farms to raise produce for local food banks. But he's also planning on raising something else. Alligators. Yes, you heard correctly. He's planning on raising alligators in Indiana, aquaponically, indoors. Jonathan explains how his alligator raising plans came about and why it will help his produce farming efforts.
I was working with the guys down at Flanner House, and they were talking about aquaponics, which aquaponics had always fascinated me. I really do believe that is the future of farming, you know, to where you're able to harvest both seafood and vegetable crop from the same source. And it has a very low impact on the environment. And so I started looking. I was looking online at different things, and I seen that there was this, like, aquaponics setup with alligators. And I was like, that's interesting, you know. It's just
raising alligators.
Raising alligators. Yeah, they were raising alligators, and they were using the alligators to feed their vegetables.
The waste, the manure.
Correct. Right. And okay. I was like, well, that's kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And I really, really, really thought about it. So we're down there at a meeting, and there's all these guys are down there. And
so you're like, in Florida?
No, we were actually in downtown Indianapolis.
Oh, my goodness.
The Flanner House.
Okay, so you're here.
And I said, I think I'm going to open up an aquaponics system that, you know, we employ alligators as our media to grow.
Okay.
To grow, you know, stuff. The looks that I got in that room were just, you know.
Well, I bet, right?
You know, Brandon Cosby, the executive director of Flanner, he goes, well, at least you won't have to put an alarm system on your, nobody wants to break into there.
Right.
But, you know, it was kind of a, you know, this is a, you know, just an idea, which it's just floating out there. So, and I had been to Florida, and I had toured alligator farms.
Okay.
But when we went to Florida over the holidays with the intent to do like a 2.5 week farm tour. And the weirdest thing is a lot of those farmers down there know who I am because of what I'm doing here.
Oh, that's right.
And one of them like rolled out the red carpet for us and, you know, viewing it, and I told him how I was interested in aquaponics and alligators. He goes, well, there's a farm you need to go to then. So I go, and sure enough, he's got it set up.
An aquaponic farm where they raise
alligators
and vegetables?
And vegetables. And
okay.
He's got it completely set up. And it's in South Florida, but it's completely indoors, temperature controlled. And it was just, it was awesome. And he gave me a sample of a tomato that was grown from just catfish being used. And in all honesty, it was very bland. And then he gave me a sample of a tomato that was being grown using the alligator waste. And it tasted like a field-grown tomato. I was shocked.
So an aquaponic-grown tomato fertilized with
alligator waste. Yeah.
And
he told me, he goes, I have no scientific evidence other than the visual, but he goes, you know, when alligators use the bathroom, it looks like a big chicken. Looks like a chicken had used the bathroom, just much larger.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So
that's interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, chicken manure, some of the best manure you can use. There are drawbacks, you know. I have purchased 4 alligators.
You have your own personal alligators now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess they're mine until I can figure out, you know, but they're going to be shipped up here. They're all 2 foot long,
okay.
2 males and 2 females.
And you're going to raise them.
And we're going to start out with those. They were captive bred and have been tested free of salmonella. That's a big thing that we need to make sure.
Okay.
And we'll put them into tanks that are completely closed off. The only thing that the plants that get fertilized from these will, the only thing that the water from these animals will touch will be their roots. It'll be a completely sealed system. So, and we're going to keep them on 100% fish diet.
Oh my goodness! So your alligators will be eating fish,
mm-hmm.
and then they will provide waste matter that will be fertilizing the vegetables.
Correct.
Oh my goodness! All indoors.
All indoors. Yeah, yeah, and that's just. You know, the one thing that kind of bothered me, I was like, so what do you do to keep from being bitten, you know?
But that is a question, right?
That was my number one question. And he told me, he goes, well, if you're going to work with them, it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when.
Oh, so you are going to be bitten.
That's what he planned. I'm going to try to break that mold.
Now tell me, how long do you raise the alligators? How big will they get cut? See, that's a concern.
Ours, we will stop at 5 foot. And since it's going to be 2 years out, I mean, it's not a super fast growing animal.
Okay.
He's telling me anywhere from 1 to 2 foot a year is what they grow. They're not a really fast growing animal, and their value to me is more of the manure that they're providing that's free and
right.
constantly recycling.
But you'll harvest the animals, too,
yeah,
so someone will want to purchase alligator meat, for
yeah.
example.
So at some point, the way it's kind of set up now in the state of Indiana, I know with shrimp have to be delivered pretty much whole and alive to whoever's wanting them, and then they process them themselves. Mm-hmm. But that's shrimp. That's not
okay.
an animal with a 3,000 pounds pressure bite.
right. So how is the alligator processed?
Well, we're going to have to probably either do the processing ourselves and be set up through the state of Indiana to go through their process, which isn't unheard of as far as, you know, there are other farms who set up their own processing.
They have their own processing facilities.
Except
sure.
our processing will be a little bit different because number one, it's not something that, you know, I can process a hog right now.
Okay.
Even though I don't have the facilities, I know how to do it.
But alligator?
Alligator is kind of an art form because their value to us is not just in their meat. It's also their skin,
yes,
which,
right.
we can sell for about $3.50 a centimeter.
A centimeter.
A centimeter. So you've got to know how to.
You don't want to damage that skin, do you?
Correct. Yeah. And I think, you know, the ability for kids, whether they're rural kids or kids living in the city to come out, see the facility, see the alligators. You know, it just the alligator part has made me think, you know, how we can start thinking about different types of protein that aren't so detrimental on our environment. One thing, when I was down there, I was in Immokalee, and I had to take a double take because I seen, like, it looked like a giant dragon sitting in a tree,
okay.
and it was a big iguana.
All right.
And we had a potluck dinner with the Immokalee workers, farm workers, that evening. And iguana was on the menu.
And?
they went and
right?
hunted it.
And?
It does not taste like chicken. It tastes
okay.
much better than chicken.
okay.
It has almost no fat. It has like 5 to 6 times the amount of protein that chicken does, you know. And these are the alternative sources of protein that, you know, people in South Florida are just getting used to.
So do you feel that we'll be exploring those alternative types of proteins in the future?
I think we need to, just because, I mean, you know, we currently have hogs. We've done cattle in the past. It's just, I don't believe in confining animals. I hate that. But at the same time, I've done pastured hogs and I've done confined hogs. And if I want to get a hog to the market as fast as I can, and as cheap as I can so that the consumer doesn't have to pay that much, confinement will beat pastured every day. Now, they don't beat them in taste or health. I mean,
just,
you know,
speed and cost.
Yeah. My hogs right now, I have guinea hogs. They have no vaccines. They're out on pasture. I don't have to do anything for them other than make sure that the fence
and
is
keep
hot.
Them fenced in.
Yeah,
right.
Keep them fenced in. And supply them with supplemental grain, you know, especially in the summertime. I don't even supply them with anything.
They just forage. Right?
They just forage, you know. So in a perfect world, you know, if we were willing to get 1/3 of our society to go back to agrarian roots, which I doubt that will ever happen.
Right.
You know, we could go to pastured animals. But the way it is now, I think alternative meat sources, fish, do not mind the confinement.
Right.
The alligators do not mind the confinement. They actually thrive in it. You know, so they're healthier. They're, you know, they don't have to worry about disease. The one reason why he keeps his animals inside is because of mosquitoes. The West Nile virus will kill an alligator. So it's one of the few things on the planet that will kill an alligator. But
so the confined alligators don't have to worry about
exactly
about that. So they're exactly. happy to and laze around.
And you know, so if someone buys an alligator belt and it comes from one of the alligators that we raise, that's one alligator that wasn't hunted in the wild. That was one that was raised, and every bit of it was used.
We've been talking with Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms in Hancock County. For more information, go to brandywinecreekfarms.org or look for it on Facebook. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. And I have to say, this time of year is an exciting one for me as a fan of local chefs and restaurants. This past week, the James Beard Foundation released its list of semifinalists for their Restaurant and Chef Awards, often called the Oscars of the food world. I'm always excited to see which Indiana chefs and restaurateurs have made the list, and this year we have three chefs and a local restaurateur. In Indianapolis, Chef Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth and Chef Abby Maris of Bluebeard are semifinalists for Best Chef in the Great Lakes region, and Martha Hoover of Patashoe Inc. is a semifinalist for Outstanding Restaurateur, a national award. Chef Aaron Butts of Fort Wayne is also a semifinalist for Best Chef Great Lakes. Now, he's been a semifinalist in the past when he was executive chef at Joseph DeQuise in Roanoke, Indiana. But this year, he opened his own restaurant with Chef Sean Richardson, The Golden in Fort Wayne. And this year, Aaron earned another nod as a James Beard semifinalist. Today we revisit last year's interview with Aaron after he worked his last service at Joseph DeQuise and before he had opened The Golden.
The past 15 years has been just growing as a chef, you know, learning, constantly learning up until the last week there. Trying to bring something different, creative, some fresh ideas to the community, and really like honesty in the food, you know, like no shortcuts. Everything's made from scratch. Everything's real, you know, working with real farmers and all that stuff became very important to me in the past, you know, 7-8 years, I guess.
Well, now you've been there since you were very young, you know,
yeah.
And so this has been your professional career.
Oh, yeah. I started when I was 23. I've been cooking since I was in high school. And that's really all I know. I started cooking. I just kind of took a job and as a dishwasher. And I was like, a buddy of mine actually talked me into the job. I was like, oh, come work here, man. They're paying blah, 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 dishwashing. I was like, oh, cool. And when I started, I didn't realize I was actually his replacement. So he left and went to work on the line. And I was stuck in the dish tank. I'm like, what are you doing? So I quickly got out of the dish tank and started doing salads for that hotel. And there was a fine dining restaurant attached to that hotel called Mallory's. And I was, like, watching the pastry chef. And one day he ended up quitting all of a sudden. And I was, like, the only buddy that knew what he was doing back there. I knew how to make the desserts and plate the desserts and whatnot. And, you know, I was 17. And
oh my goodness, now is this in Fort Wayne?
This is Fort Wayne, yeah. Don Hall's guest house, yeah. And, you know, the chefs at the time, there's only two chefs on the line, really small kitchen, small restaurant. And they're looking at me, and I'm like, I'm in high school. I mean, I'll do it. I'll fill in or whatever. And I ended up doing pastries for that restaurant, and which was like the finest restaurant in Fort Wayne. And you know, years later, I ended up being the executive chef of that restaurant, and I got it, you know, it clicked with me, I was good at it, I loved it, I loved the atmosphere of the kitchen, being behind the line.
Was it something you had planned to do? You know, there you are as a 17-year-old high school guy?
No, I had no plans. I mean, my plan was to be a cop, you know, I didn't have serious plans to be a cop, but my dad was a police officer, and I was going to follow kind of in his footsteps. And actually, still to this day, I still have like a kind of want to be a cop. Probably a little too old for that now, but I just like kind of fell into it. And I don't know if I would have been better at something else, you know. I don't know, but I definitely couldn't see myself in a cubicle or construction or anything like that, you know.
Well, you clearly have an aptitude for it. I mean, you've been at it a while. You have won awards. The restaurant has a fabulous reputation. So it seems like it's worked out.
It has. It's working out so far. Yeah. We'll see what this next step brings.
Well, speaking of the next step, so tell me, you know, what where you're at now. So New Year's Eve service was your last service at Joseph DeQuise. So what's coming next?
Well, the next step is we're going to open up our own restaurant in downtown Fort Wayne in the new Ash Building. It's called The Golden.
Now, why is it called that?
The Golden is myself and Sean Richardson, who is my sous chef at the restaurant and good friend. We started this pop-up craft cocktail thing, and we called it The Golden. You know, it was something to bring craft cocktails to Fort Wayne, which was severely lacking in that kind of service, and also something fun for us to do and learn, you know.
So now you've been doing that for the last year or so?
Yeah, just about a year and a half or so now. Yeah, well, a little over a year and a half. We actually took, like, 2015, we didn't do much. We were so busy in the restaurant, farm events, weddings. Sean was traveling. Sean was in France. He was staging at Blue Hill. So we didn't have a lot of time to do a lot of craft cocktail events, but we also ended up planning what is to be The Golden. So,
well, you were also studying, too, and taking classes, right?
Yes. Sean and I both took the Academy spirits class through Southern Wine and Spirits, both graduating high in the class and everything, and it's a great experience.
So now, how was it approaching craft cocktails as a chef?
For us, some of it seemed easy, like the balance of flavors and tastes are kind of like innate to us. You know, we can taste something and be like, oh, it needs a little bit of acid, needs a little bit of sweet, needs a little more diluted a little bit. We understand that, you know, which I think gives us a little leg up on maybe not bartenders, like seasoned bartenders, but other people. You know, you can see somebody making a drink like, I don't know what this needs, you know. So we have that ability.
Did you like the different focus? You know, you said, you know, you'd been doing the pop-up cocktail thing, you know, you were learning about it and studying it, and did you like it?
Loved it. I mean, I was going to hang up my chef jacket and trade it in for a jigger and a shaker. I really thought I was going to turn into a bartender, you know.
No, that's kind of interesting, you know, because, you know, for a chef who's won so many awards, to think about switching that. What was the appeal?
Something new. Not that I've learned everything there is to know about cooking, because scratching the surface, but something new and something fun. It's another aspect of service, you know, and the food industry. I just loved it. I love the people. The people I met down here in Indianapolis through the Academy, and I've made some lifelong friends, I feel, you know. And I don't know, it's a really cool, it's a cool atmosphere. It's a cool lifestyle.
Well, you've done some competitions. I remember a chef versus bartender competitions. So you dove into it.
Yes. Josh Gonzalez barely beat us, I think. We've done some cooking competitions as The Golden, I guess Greg Hardesty, and we've done some cocktail competitions and whatnot. We're not really into competition stuff. It's fun.
But it seems like you've been enjoying it, really enjoying that part of it.
Oh, I enjoy everything. I'm a pretty easy guy.
We've been talking with Chef Aaron Butts, a 2017 James Beard Award semifinalist and an owner of The Golden in Fort Wayne. For more information on Aaron and the restaurant, check out goldenfw.com. So here's a cool idea. What if you could go to a local coffee shop, order a latte, and then enjoy your coffee with a cat curled up on your lap? Or sit on a couch and twirl a cat toy while a little calico chased it around? Well, that's a reality now, since the Nine Lives Cat Cafe has opened in Fountain Square. Owner Selena Hubbard and her dad Eric seem to have a hit on their hands, as a cat-loving public has embraced their new cat cafe. I stopped in this week to check it out and talk with them about what it's been like at Indy's new Nine Lives Cat Cafe.
I first read years ago about cat cafes in Asia. I believe the first one was in Taiwan. And I read about ones in Japan and South Korea, and I was like, oh, this is the most amazing idea ever. I love coffee. I love cats. Whoever thought of this is just like a genius. And then they weren't in the U.S. at the time, and just the health department regulations would not allow, like in Japan, you know, the cats are crawling on the counters and things like that, and that would not go over very well here. But whenever they started opening in the U.S., they had made a division with the cats on one side and then coffee on the other side with a wall. So they were in separate rooms. And so then they started popping up all over the U.S. with that same, like, concept of, like, dividing the place in half. And so we're like, okay, cat cafes can happen in the U.S. We need this to happen in Indy. So
now, did you get much pushback? Did people think that was kind of the idea was a little out there?
Yeah, well, it kind of just depends. Like, people are like really black and white on it. It's either, oh my gosh, that's the best idea. I love cats. I love coffee. You guys are great. Or it's just like, ew, that sounds terrible. I'm not a cat lover. I don't want cat fur in my coffee. It's going to stink. Like, you hear all these different things. So people are either like really negative about it or they're really, really excited. And there's not really a gray area, which is kind of funny.
Now, you're in, opened this with your dad, Eric. So what did you think about the idea when the idea of a cat cafe came up?
Well, I was always receptive to the idea of partnering with her for business. It's something that we had talked about when she was a young teenager. But when she brought up the cats, you know, I'm the boring business part of this partnership, and it was a tough sell for her. I knew that they existed. I wasn't really sure what Indianapolis would think of a cat cafe. And when it became apparent that we were going to be self-funding, then it became even more critical that we have a solid business plan and really have a good idea that we were going to be able to make this. So it was a tough sell for her.
Now, you mentioned self-funded. Is this doesn't strike me as something that a bank is going to say, oh, sure, go ahead and let me give you a loan.
Right. They did not say that. We did speak to a couple of banks. We started to go down a direction of trying to buy a building. We explored options for business loans, small business loans. The banks felt like it was a pretty high risk. I would say there is one bank that was receptive to the idea, but we would have really to put up so much of our assets, our personal assets, to be able to make this happen that it wasn't feasible for us. So
how did you make it work then?
We started a GoFundMe, and that kind of helped, although I would say it really wasn't too successful. We got maybe about almost a tenth of what we originally wanted. So it did help. Yes, thank you for all those people who donated, although it did not pay to open this place. Instead, we basically used my dad's savings to open it. So I'm in debt to him, definitely.
So because, you know, I can understand, you know, the idea is a little unusual, but it seems to have really taken off. So I think that there must have been some interest out there, some pent-up demand that we didn't know that we had for a cat cafe.
Well, really, part of what made all this work was the alliances and partnerships that we made with people who are like-minded. So even though we were on this endeavor on our own, we really weren't. Our Our coffee roaster, for instance, is also helped us. He also helped us do the build out. Our bakers are all local people, small business owners. Gosh, you know, it just, we couldn't have made it happen without them. So we actually had a pretty big partnership, you know, multi-person, multi-business partnership that was helping us out in various ways. But yeah, it was difficult, and it did slow things down.
So now, how did you get going? How does the process work from the idea of thinking, I'm going to have a cat cafe, to actually getting it up and running?
Well, so we had to draw up some business plans, and we really kind of had to proof the business concept as much as we could. We had to do a lot of research first to, you know, determine whether it was even feasible to put a cat cafe in Indy. So Selena actually took on a lot of that research, and I'd say probably months worth of research, and you know, came up with what we thought was going to be a good solid plan. And then of course we just kind of went from there and started trying to solidify it into a real business. So
now tell me how it works for people who aren't might not be able to imagine how you can have a coffee shop with the cats and that sort of thing. How does it all work?
Well, basically, one side is just a normal coffee shop. Our space is divided in half. So we have the normal coffee shop on one side, and you can just come in, order coffee, and sit down and work or do whatever you'd like in a normal coffee shop. And then the other half is a room filled with adoptable cats from the Humane Society of Indianapolis. And it's kind of like a living room sort of environment. There's comfy seating in there and tables, and then there's just like a bunch of cat trees and cat toys and cats, of course. And so you can bring your coffee and food in there if you'd like, or you can just sit on the coffee shop side.
And there are windows so that you can watch the cats from the coffee shop side too.
Yep. So even if you don't want to go into the cat side, you can definitely watch the cats play. And a lot of people seem to enjoy that. And so we do 12 people at one time in the cat lounge. That's what we call it. So in the cat lounge, there are 12 people at one time. And we recommend reservations for that just because sometimes it can get full pretty quickly. And we do $5 for an hour in there, or $3 for half an hour, and the money helps us to for the upkeep of that room, taking care of the cats, and of course taking care of the employees that work on that side and make sure that everybody's playing safe with the cats and the cats are playing safe with the people.
Now, tell me how the cat part of it works. These cats are adoptable, right?
Yeah, all the cats are from the Humane Society of Indianapolis. And basically, if somebody comes in and sees a cat that they fall in love with, then they can talk to an employee and we'll show them how to apply for the cat. And from there, Indy Humane takes on the rest of the adoption process. So we're basically kind of like a foster home or an off-site free roaming cat room for them. And then the Humane Society just does the whole adoption process basically.
So tell me how opening day was, or when you first opened. I would imagine it was a little crazy.
Yeah, it was definitely crazy. We actually started out with a Yelp event, and we had, I think it was like 200 people in just a few hours. So it was definitely really crazy. And the whole rest of the day was just like, it's just a blur now. It was so many people came in just to check us out, which was awesome. And really, ever since then, weekends have been booked. They've been really busy, and evenings have been pretty busy as well. So a lot of people are still coming to check us out.
So they make a reservation and they come in, and then what's it like? What happens?
So basically, whenever you make a reservation, you can check in at the counter at the coffee bar, and we can make you a drink or get you a pastry if you'd like. And then you go into the cat room, and we have you sign a little waiver before you go in. And we have a little bit, or we have a few rules to look over. That's just to make sure that everybody is safe and the cats and the people are both safe. And then you can just go chill out over there and have coffee and play with the cats.
So. Now these cats, these are friendly people-friendly cats, and so you really can play with them, pet them, hold them. Is that right?
Yeah, they all seem to really like people, which is great. The Humane Society has chosen cats for our location. That's like, they're specifically like super friendly cats. They're the ones that they think would do really well over here. They're very social, very playful. And so you can definitely play with them. And some of them you can pick up. We do ask that that you ask the employee who's in there, our cat wrangler, which ones are okay with being picked up. But there's a couple we have in there right now that just like want to be held like babies. They're so cute.
We've been talking with Selena Hubbard and her dad, Eric, owners of Nine Lives Cat Cafe in Indianapolis. Stay with us for more on the Cat Cafe here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio talking with the owners of the new Nine Lives Cat Cafe in Indianapolis. It's a coffee shop on one side, divided by a wall of windows from the Cat Lounge, where customers can make a reservation to spend 30 minutes or an hour hanging out with adoptable cats. It's a fun concept, and I headed into the Cat Lounge with owner Selena Hubbard and her dad Eric while adults and toddlers enjoyed the cats, who really seemed to like all the attention.
They have like a little back room over here, or back room. It's employees only, but the cats are also like employees. So that's where they can go back and take a break if they want from the people and kind of have some quiet time.
So now how many cats do you have in here right now?
At the moment we have 5, and usually we have 8 to 10. Recently we had a few picked up for adoption, so we'll probably be getting some more that need homes here really soon. We do try to keep it to 8 to 10 at most times because we allow 12 people in here, so we want to keep the cat-to-human ratio pretty high if possible.
So now, is there any downside for the cats? You know, they seem to be enjoying the attention.
Yeah, it actually seems like they really enjoy the attention. They are getting treated like royalty. They get treats and loved on all the time and played with constantly. So it seems like most of them really enjoy their time here. And even the people from the shelter say, like, oh, the cats seem so happy here. So, yeah, I think that they love it.
Did it turn out the way you had in mind? Is this how you envisioned it?
Pretty close, I would say. I did, like, I don't know how exactly, like, I totally envisioned it. I just envisioned, you know, something similar, and I think it came pretty close to what we were hoping for.
So she is definitely the creative side of the partnership, and then I'm the business side primarily. And this is pretty much, you know, her dream, and so I wanted her to kind of make it what she wanted it to be, and she's going to be running the day-to-day operations, so it had to be, you know, she had to be happy with it. So
is this what you had in mind when you started talking about going into business with your daughter and having a cat cafe?
Yes and no. I'm really pleased with it. I think you know, from a professional standpoint, I grew professionally because of this, you know, I actually do delve in other things business related, and I teach and all that, but it's different to put it into practice. And you know, for me, it was a test of our ability to really develop a good business plan, determine whether we're going to be not for profit or for profit. I have a not-for-profit as well, and I think it would be difficult to make this a completely not-for-profit endeavor. So we found a good match, and we're going to be a good business model, I hope, for other cat cafes that show up. And you know, we really do have a big charitable footprint that I think we want to just put out there and show people the right way to do a business and help cats at the same time. So
now, what are the hours?
Monday through Thursday, we're open 8 in the morning until 9 at night. And then on Friday and Saturday, we're open 9 in the morning till 10 at night. And then on Sunday, we're just open 9 to 6.
And do you have people there pretty much all the time?
The mornings have been actually pretty slow. It's mostly more of an afternoon and evening type of thing. That's when it gets really busy, and the weekends are just completely packed. But if you want to have a really quiet time and basically have the room to yourself, then mornings are definitely the time to come, especially like before 11. That's when it starts getting a little bit busier. But you could probably get away with having the room to yourself and like a nice quiet time with all the cats.
Now, what's it like at night? You know, are they active at night too?
Yeah, I'd say that especially after dark, especially the last couple of time slots, we do time slots by the hour. I'd say the last like two time slots or so, two or three, the cats start like waking up again and they're super active and they just want to play. And I think they know food is coming pretty soon too, so you know how that goes.
When we're trying to get cleaned up and leave is when they're really the most active, it seems like.
They run around and like slide on the floors. They're just insanely crazy sometimes. It's really funny.
We've been talking with Selena Hubbard and her dad Eric, owners of the Nine Lives Cat Cafe in Indianapolis. For more information or to make a reservation for the popular cat lounge, go to ninelivesindy.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thanks so much for tuning in to our eclectic show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Master Gardener Joellen Meyer Sharp of HoosierGardener.com, Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms, Chef and James Beard Award semifinalist Aaron Butts of The Golden in Fort Wayne, and Selena Hubbard and Eric Hubbard of Nine Lives Cat Cafe in Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.